Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Presidential elections are planned distractions to divert attention from the action behind the scenes. Like a game of chess when the house is a mess, or a petty money squabble when your marriage is in trouble, or a football game when there's rioting in the streets.
Tim Buck 3 opens our podcast today, and I invite you to listen to this conversation with mainstream media analyst Mark Halperin. He was the top political guy at ABC News for many years, went on to MSNBC, also worked on Showtime. He's got a new book out called How to Beat Trump. And we have a lively exchange sparring over several issues about Bernie Sanders, his electability, the rise of Mike Bloomberg, and our discussion took place within 24 hours of the SmackDown debate that occurred earlier this week in Las Vegas. So I think you'll find this fascinating, and also you'll get some insights into how moderate Democrats, corporate Democrats, and those in the mainstream media think, because Mark Halperin has quite a network of sources, and I think he shares in a very interesting way. We also discuss his intersection with the Me Too movement. He was accused of inappropriate behavior when he was working at ABC, and later in the interview, he candidly addresses those issues. Here's my conversation with Mark Halperin.
Joining us today on the Peter B. Collins podcast is Mark Halperin, a long-running journalist and media figure who has worked for ABC News, where he was the top political reporter. You've also seen him on MSNBC. He worked for Mike Bloomberg's network and might have some insights on the newest presidential candidate. And you may recall his HBO series, actually it was on Showtime, sorry, called The Circus, where he co-anchored the show with John Heilman and Mark McKinnon back during the 2016 presidential cycle. Mark, it's great to be with you today.
Great to be talking to you, Peter. Happy to be here.
So we're speaking less than 24 hours after the Las Vegas debate, and boy, did Elizabeth Warren come out with two switchblades slashing everything in sight.
Yeah, you know, when candidates do that, it works a lot better if they're speaking from the heart. And pretty much everything she went after Mike Bloomberg on are stuff she believes in and feels passionately about. And I think that really helped her. It was contrived in the sense that obviously she sat down beforehand with her team, but it was all very much in her wheelhouse of what she believes in, why she wants to be president, and why she doesn't think Michael Bloomberg should be the Democratic nominee. So she's a former Republican, but she's been a Democrat for a while. And I think she was expressing not just on issues of non-disclosure agreements and on issues of his wealth, and some of the other things she talked about, but I think she was reflecting an underappreciated aspect of Michael Bloomberg's candidacy, which is a lot of Democrats say this guy's not really a Democrat based on his history, based on his policy positions, and she really took it to him. I certainly think it hurt Mike Bloomberg. We'll see if it helps her in the next couple of days.
Some writers at The Intercept said that this may end up being a murder-suicide. And she certainly, you know, hit Mike Bloomberg in ways that have set him back. But has this compromised her? And I reference the mid-January debate in Iowa, which was part of this orchestrated effort by the Warren campaign to take Sanders down a few notches. the complaints about volunteers using talking points that compared the voter groups that each candidate attracted. I thought that was a silly, non-essential issue. And then the boo-hoo about Bernie said that a woman can't win in 2020, I think that made her look weaker. And when you look at some of the aggregated polls that are graphed, her numbers went sharply down from the plateau that she had landed on after her peak last September and October. So I think it's an open question whether these, you know, very strong attacks by Warren will help her with voters in the upcoming primaries, particularly Super Tuesday in California.
I think you're absolutely right about what happened in January, and I think you're right to question whether this will help her. I think the reality is that her campaign was in serious jeopardy of ending. And even if she doesn't expand her support, she's raised several million dollars since the debate ended. And she's proven to her supporters that she can use the debates to change the paradigm. So I think if you look at the status of her campaign now, people are talking about her. She's raising money. It may not bring her all the way back. It may not revive her candidacy in any fundamental way. But I think she's better off than she was before that debate, even though, as you suggested, it may not necessarily work. I think that right now, before we know how this will affect her, I think that the potential comparison is what happened 4 years ago on the Republican side, where Governor Christie took out Marco Rubio in the New Hampshire debate, just took him out and made fun of him for repeating himself. And Christie thought it would help him. It didn't revive his candidacy at all, but it didn't hurt him necessarily. But that wasn't a murder-suicide. That was just a murder, and then the guy left. So I think that it probably will help her in the sense that she'll be inspired to stay in until at least the next couple of debates, and that puts her in a better position than she was before.
Well, in a more recent reference, Tulsi Gabbard was very effective in knocking out Senator Kamala Harris, and it didn't benefit Tulsi Gabbard.
Yeah. Well, look, that congresswoman, was starting from a pretty big hole. It may have benefited her. You know, the difference between after that and before that's hard to say because she was never really a huge player in this race. At the same time, you know, as you pointed out, Warren was once leading in some polls in Iowa and doing better in the national polls than she's doing now. So, you know, she's got a higher floor than she's currently at. Gabbard, I don't think, you know, had a much higher floor than she had at any point when she was tangling with Senator Harris. So we'll see if Warren can just get back to where she was. She'll be back in the hunt. And in theory, those people could be for her because they once were for her not that long ago.
Mark, we'll talk a little more about what transpired in Las Vegas last night, but you've been covering presidential campaigns since 1988, and by default, you've been watching these debates. We used to have a presidential debate commission, and often it was moderated by Jim Lehrer from PBS, and these were snooze fests, to be fair, but they were much fairer in the way the debates were structured. And I ask you to compare the old style with the free-for-all shark tank with, you know, chum being provided by the moderators that we saw on television last night.
It's very difficult to do these debates. When I was at ABC, I worked with Peter Jennings and other anchors on preparing. And you really do struggle to ask questions that will create news, because that's what people in the news business want to do, but you also want to be able to use that unique type of forum to give voters more information about the candidates. And, you know, you're not going to, with timed answers or even in a more open format, you're not going to get people to explain their 17-point plan for jobs or healthcare or anything else. Really, it's about leadership and style and who gives people confidence that person would be a good president, a good nominee. And I think the current trend in all media to be, you know, a sensationalist is certainly changed the emphasis of these debates. But it's difficult to make them substantive. And once you are going for personality and for conflict, things can spiral out of control. But I still think it can reveal character. It can reveal leadership ability, regardless of how contentious it gets. So I do think they're different. I do think they're not as good. But as I said, they're challenging. And as long as the candidates do more talking than the moderators, I generally am pretty happy.
Now, Amy Klobuchar was the target of a gotcha question. I call the guy AMLO, the president of Mexico, because he's got four names, and it is hard to capture all that and be able to summon it when it's demanded. And so how do you see the balance between a gotcha question that can actually reveal something about the candidate and something that's just exploiting a mind fart?
Now, I'm going to disagree with you on this. If she had been asked who the leader of Niger was, or Monaco, I could have understand her not knowing. And maybe she just, quote-unquote, forgot, but she could have described him. She could have named his political party. She could have named the previous things he's done.
Do you think that she had a binder? She was going to a Telemundo interview.
Yeah.
Was likely this would come up. Do you think she threw that binder at one of her staffers?
I mean, it's on her. I mean, anyone who's a United States senator should know who the Prime Minister of Mexico is, President of Mexico is, rather. And so I don't think that's a gotcha question. You know, my rule in doing interviews or being involved with debates is try to ask questions that the candidate or the politician has never been asked before and isn't expecting. Is it a gotcha question to ask them how much a quart of milk costs? You know, is it a gotcha question to say how much does a gallon of gas cost? I don't think so.
It's really funny that you mention the price of milk. In 1992, I coordinated, we had two Senate seats open here, and I coordinated debates between my radio station, a TV station, and the San Francisco Examiner. And we got Dianne Feinstein on the set. And I don't want to take credit for this. It was Ana Chavez, one of the TV news anchors, who said, let's ask him about the price of milk. Now, it was Feinstein and Gray Davis that I was moderating. And when Davis was asked, he said, well, my wife buys the milk.
Back then, that was an okay answer.
And when Feinstein was asked, she didn't have a clue. And she was just totally deer in the headlights. Now, I do think that's revealing because she's a wealthy woman who probably hasn't been to a supermarket in a long time.
Yeah.
And it shows the extent to which someone might be out of touch.
I bet they prepared Mike Bloomberg to know the price of absolutely everything available at a bodega. There was a time when I was asking a lot of politicians, I would say, tell me who you think the future leaders of China will be. Now, some people said that was a gotcha question. My view is, if you want to be a United States senator, or you want to run for president, given China's place in the world, you should know the answer to that. You should have an answer to that, and it shouldn't be something you memorize. It should be something you know. But a lot of people said I was asking a gotcha question. So I think if the question is revealing of not just their knowledge, but their temperament. So if you were asked what the price of a movie ticket is and you had no idea, there's a way to answer that without being embarrassed. There's a way to answer that that shows your ability to think on your feet, and that's a big part of being president. Even if you don't know the answer, which is intended to see whether you're relatable or you understand the real lives of real people, you can give an answer in a way that, even if you don't have the actual information, that shows that. And I think it's not the best test or the only test we should be giving presidential candidates, but I don't think it's a bad one.
So when you look back at the debate last night in Las Vegas, the pundits at the Washington Post declared Sanders the winner, and the pundits at the Times gave the edge to Warren for her very aggressive approach. What does Mark Halperin say?
I think Bernie Sanders went into the debate as not just the front runner, but it's someone who, if they don't figure out how to stop him, will be have the plurality of delegates. And I think he left the debate on more of a track to do that because of the poor performance of Mike Bloomberg. So I think Sanders was the winner, not necessarily in performance. When I judge the winner of debates, I always judge it not based on how they performed in the debates by some sort of theater critic or sports reporter evaluation, but who left the debate at when the debate ended in a stronger position than when it started. And I think that Sanders clearly did. I've been saying since last spring I thought it was possible that he'd win the first four states, and no one's ever won. The first two states have not been the nominee. Now, he tied in Iowa, but I think he's the odds-on favorite to have the most delegates, and I think if he has the most delegates, it's going to be very hard to stop him. So I think he's the clear winner of that debate.
Mm-hmm. And when we look at the memo that was leaked by the Bloomberg campaign just hours before the debate, and it led to an outrage statement from Amy Klobuchar. I was so offended by this. The arrogance and the sense of entitlement. And the memo I'm describing came from top advisors to Bloomberg, basically telling Warren, Buttigieg, Biden to get out of the way, that this is an unstoppable money express, and we're either going to mow you down or we're going to blame you for Bernie Sanders winning the nomination because Bloomberg, the savior, came in too late. To me, this benefits Sanders. This, together with the Bernie Bros TV spot that Bloomberg produced, the attacks that he's made about how, you know, socialist can't beat Trump, I think that this is wedging moderate Democrats into Bernie Sanders' corner, not attracting them to Bloomberg.
Mike Bloomberg is a smart guy, and he has a lot of smart people working for him. I think it's one of the dumbest things I've seen in this presidential race. First of all, I don't think it was leaked. I think they put it out, which makes it even more embarrassing. This was the message they wanted to have. Mike Bloomberg got into this race because he thought Joe Biden was going to collapse, that Bernie Sanders would end up being the Democratic nominee, and Donald Trump would be reelected. I think right now Mike Bloomberg is on a path to help Bernie Sanders get to be the nominee because he is so angering Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg and Joe Biden, who have been in this race for a long time, have spent countless hours at motels in Iowa and New Hampshire, and they're not interested in getting out of the way for Michael Bloomberg, particularly after the debate in Las Vegas. So I wondered this for a while. Does Mike Bloomberg think he's going to get the nomination and can win over Trump without the support of Bernie Sanders people? Or does he think that after he's spent the time doing this kind of thing and saying the kind of things he said about Sanders, he can win them over? I don't know which he thinks, but after last night, I don't think either of those seems like a pretty good, any like a high likelihood.
So, and Mark, you have a new book out about how to beat Trump. And I breezed through it. I didn't get to read every page. But when we look back at 2016 and we see the recriminations that have been part of these attacks on Sanders this year, Hillary, nobody likes him, Hillary saying he didn't help me. Well, the record contradicts that. And I believe it was a big failure on the part of the Clinton campaign to make any move in the direction of Sanders and his voters post-convention. They felt they had him locked down, they had nowhere else to go, they couldn't possibly vote for Trump, and that she didn't have to make movement on minimum wage or on the health care issues that Sanders had championed. And, you know, when I look back, I see that as one of the biggest self-inflicted wounds post-convention.
I agree with you about 50% on that history. First of all, I think she did make some accommodations in the platform, and her people did make some changes.
Like what?
I believe they changed their position on the student loan plan that Senator Clinton had. I think Secretary Clinton had. I think they moved it closer to Senator Sanders in terms of lowering the burden for people who took student loans. I remember that as one thing they did. But there were extensive meetings about the platform. I think that Secretary Clinton should have called Bernie Sanders on every election night, primaries and caucuses, and congratulated him. Or if he called, she should have taken the call and been gracious. They didn't do that. And so I think that she deserves, as you suggested, a lot of the blame for the failure to win over, not just Sanders personally, but his people. She had disdain for him. She thought he was treated with kid gloves by the press, and she was right about that. She got much more scrutiny than Senator Sanders did. So I understand why she was upset, but she shot herself in the foot by failing to be the bigger person and reach out, recognizing that if she were going to be the nominee, she needed his people. The part I disagree about, besides the question of whether she moved in his direction on some policy, is I think he deserves some measure of the blame. He, at the convention, you recall, the first day of the convention in Philadelphia was a mess, and he was booed by his own supporters at an event when he said you should all support Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. She then spent a lot of time, and her people spent a lot of time, trying to put things back on track. And I believe after that, he was insufficiently grateful and insufficiently energetic in trying to get his people to vote for her. I don't think he put his heart into it and his everything. Now, he'll show you his travel schedule and all the things he did, but I don't think he did as much as he could have done, and I know Secretary Clinton thinks that too, and I think there's something to that. So I think they both deserve some measure of the blame. And if you look at this year, to go back to the Bloomberg-Sanders thing, you know, if on Saturday Bernie Sanders wins the caucuses, Las Vegas, do you think Michael Bloomberg will call to congratulate him? And if he does, you think Bernie Sanders will take the call? I doubt it, and I doubt it. And that is a mistake on both their parts if they really want to beat Donald Trump. So there's no doubt that Sanders' positioning in this race, in terms of the enthusiasm and quick trigger on outrage from his supporters, and in terms of the unlikelihood that they could take the nomination away from him in a second or subsequent ballot, is a product to a large extent of what happened 4 years ago. They screwed him. It's a podcast, so I'll say that. They screwed him 4 years ago. The DNC clearly favored Hillary Clinton, and we didn't need WikiLeaks to tell us that. She didn't want the debate schedule, for instance, was geared towards exactly what she wanted.
Well, and her treasurer was the DNC treasurer, and we've never seen a full audit. And I believe that those George Clooney fundraisers where you could contribute $350,000, some of that money was not properly allocated. Some of that money was supposed to be used only in the general election, and there are indications that it was used for digital advertising for Hillary Clinton in the primary.
You're right about your theory or your suspicion about that or not. That kind of thing happened, which is to say the DNC violated both a sense of fairness and probably some rules. I don't, maybe not laws, but certainly rules in a way that clearly was intended to benefit her. And it was stupid and it was wrong. And again, the legacy of that is that the Sanders people now are always on guard. And that's why when Mike Bloomberg insults him, and why Mike Bloomberg says some of the, and puts out this kind of memo, which says Sanders can't win, and we need to stop, all the other moderates need to get out, it annoys the moderate candidates and makes them angry, but it also makes the Sanders campaign and his followers angry. So it's a real problem. And again, in the book I wrote, where I interviewed a lot of smart Democratic strategists, they said we have to come together as a party, even as we fight for the nomination, and that is not happening. And Pete Buttigieg in the debate said something that's absolutely true, which is the two leading candidates now, Mike Bloomberg, if he still is after the debate, but Mike Bloomberg and Bernie Sanders are so polarizing within the party. You know, they're so polarizing. So the chance that you've got two of these guys who are going to be finalists, Sanders because of his support and Bloomberg because of his money, who are so polarizing, it's very difficult to see the DNC or Barack Obama or Nancy Pelosi bringing this party together around almost anybody in this race, because it's become binary. You're either for Sanders or Warren, or you're for one of the moderates. And there's not a lot of sort of overlap of feeling, despite this huge interest amongst most Democrats to beat Donald Trump at all costs.
But I think these are false memes, all right? Number one, I do understand that Bernie Sanders is perceived at the left edge of the Democratic Party. But he has championed the issues that every candidate is running on with varying degrees of emphasis.
I'd say I don't agree with that, in the sense that there are four positions as Bernie Sanders has that, for instance, Joe Biden doesn't have and Mike Bloomberg doesn't have. Single-payer health care, taking private health insurance away from 150 or 180.
Wait a minute. That's a Republican talking point. It is, Mark. No, because, number one, it assumes that everybody loves the health insurance they have today, and Warren has made a joke out of that, and it's an accurate one. Number two, it's simply replacing the insurance mechanism, not the coverage that you have. It will actually expand coverage for virtually everybody who doesn't have a Cadillac plan.
Well, a lot of people who have private health insurance have Cadillac plans. I don't know what the percentage is. And again, Cadillac is a term that's a little bit vague. Most of the studies that I have seen suggest that a lot of the people who have private health insurance now will may or may not pay more or less, but have plans that do not cover as much as would be covered under a government plan. So I don't think it's a Republican talking point. I think it's factually true. They would lose their private health insurance. Now, I accept the argument that you made and that Senator Sanders made, is that they might pay less out of pocket overall, even if their taxes went up, because they wouldn't have premiums and copays. And I accept the fact that that may be a more just system, and I've never understood why the United States is the only industrialized democracy that doesn't have universal health care, and most of them have single payer. But I do think that that it's not a Republican talking point or something that people are reacting to because they're ill-informed. People who have their private health insurance, who in many cases, particularly with union laborers, accepted lower wages for a very good, whether you call it a Cadillac plan or not, private health insurance, they're not inclined to accept something that the U.S. has never tried for whatever reason. So private health insurance taken away is something Sanders is for, that Joe Biden is not for, Pete Buttigieg is not for, Amy Klobuchar is not for, Mike Bloomberg is not for. The Green New Deal, all the Democrats are for dealing with energy, dealing with the environment. But the Green New Deal, in terms of its expense, in terms of its level of regulation, you know, Nancy Pelosi is not for the Green New Deal. Providing private health insurance or publicly funded health insurance to people who come to the country illegally, that's not a popular position, and Bernie Sanders is for that. And decriminalizing the border, saying that if you come to this country illegally, it's a civil offense rather than a criminal offense. Those four positions, if Bernie Sanders is the nominee, I'm not sure Donald Trump will talk about anything else but those four positions. And I know plenty of Democrats who have won presidential campaigns as strategists who say those four positions alone would make it impossible for Bernie Sanders to win. So I don't think that is an exaggeration or a creation of differences where they don't exist to say that Senator Sanders has some positions which are popular with tens of millions of Americans, but most strategists I know in both parties don't think those are positions that would be a good foundation for a general election win. And I'll say one more thing about it. Those four positions, every Democrat in a competitive race, House, Senate, or any other race in the country, will repudiate those four positions. It would be unprecedented. We've never had a presidential candidate where every candidate down ballot in a contested race says about the primary positions, the most fundamental positions of the presidential nominee, I repudiate them. And I think that would be the sum total of every Donald Trump ad. You'd have Democrats talking about how unacceptable and unwise Bernie Sanders' positions are.
Well, I understand the argument, and I also see that in the recent polling, Democrats by large majorities support Sanders and believe that he can win. And I'm not dismissing that there will be bumps along the way and that some of his positions will complicate people down ballot. But the other way to frame this is that those are a result of the weakness of the Democratic Party due to corporate influence, and that as they strive to maintain the flow of dollars from people who are much more conservative and who have different interests than the average American, I think that the Democratic Party has become the number two corporate party, and if Bloomberg is the nominee, it'll be the number two plutocrat party. And so I think that we're seeing a lot of exaggeration of the fears of Sanders' agenda, because agendas are for marketing, right? That's how you attract voters. I don't know anybody who believes that Bernie Sanders in his first year in office is going to implement every element of that agenda. He's got to struggle through Congress to get single payer.
Yeah.
He's got to struggle to get any kind of comprehensive immigration reform. But he is articulating a clear agenda that is a stark contrast from the status quo.
Yeah.
And that, in my view, is what wins elections.
Let me say three things about that. First, I think that Senator Sanders, if he's elected, will have an easier time passing some of these big things than is commonly thought. I think that it will be considered such a revolution, regardless of the final makeup of the House and the Senate. But I believe if he wins, Democrats will control both the House and the Senate, not a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. But I believe that he will be given a chance to pass these things, because it will be a huge mandate. Number two, I totally agree with you about corporate and labor, big labor influence and control of a lot of our government, state and local and national federal government. I think it's an extraordinary outrage, and I think that people in both parties, and Donald Trump talked about it, he hasn't lived it as president, but he talked about it because he knows that it resonates. However, Do you think Nancy Pelosi is controlled by corporate interests? She takes a lot of money from rich people and from people associated with corporations. Do you think she's...
Well, her majority is fueled by $300 million that came from Mike Bloomberg.
I understand, but do you think when she makes decisions about what legislation to support, what legislation to put on the floor, do you think that she is a tool of corporate America?
I'm afraid, and let me explain that I've known Pelosi since she went to Congress. I worked as a campaign advisor for her during one cycle back in the 1990s. I have the highest respect for her, but in the leadership position, she has shifted quite a bit. And yes, I do believe she is unduly influenced by corporate money and by the people who she travels with and rubs elbows with.
Yeah, I mean, I think she's definitely... influenced by it, but I don't think it motivates her primary decisions. I really do think that to support the Green New Deal is not because corporations don't like it. I think and energy companies don't like it. I think she doesn't support it because she doesn't think the traffic will bear some of the implications of it in terms of regulation and jobs and taxes. So if the country were as liberal as Bernie Sanders is. Now, tens of millions of people in the country are as liberal as Bernie Sanders and love his agenda. And I have been probably amongst people in the so-called mainstream media. I have been a strong supporter of, or a strong opponent of people in the press decrying him as a crazy old socialist. He speaks to the aspirations of tens of millions of Americans, their frustrations, their fears, and their aspirations. But I don't think those positions, and I don't think Nancy Pelosi thinks those positions, are majority positions right now. Now, I have a huge amount of respect for him because I know he knows that in some ways, and that he thinks his responsibility, as you suggested before, is to raise these issues, say this is the right thing, and to try to build greater support for it. I think that's great, but I don't think that everyone who opposes his agenda in the Democratic Party opposes it because they're in the pocket of special interests and corporate interests and labor unions. I think some of them don't oppose it because they don't think it can pass. Some of them don't think it should pass. And some of them think it will ruin the brand of the Democratic Party. And that is the majority view of, that's what Barack Obama thinks, Nancy Pelosi thinks, Chuck Schumer thinks, Kamala Harris thinks. And that, you know, you can't discount that. You can't say that that's meaningless, particularly if your aspiration above all else in the next year is to beat Donald Trump.
Well, I would argue that Pelosi's speakership both times has been based on a Faustian bahrgain. In the first round, Rahm Emanuel recruited all of these rich, self-funding candidates. Remember Zach Womp? And
but
this
got them the majority.
No, I understand. And this time around, the Orange County flips include three people who were registered Republicans in the year before they ran as a Democrat.
Yeah.
And so her effort to protect these people from impeachment for a long time, mm-hmm. I think is based on a flawed idea that they can be protected somehow and that Trump can't tweet them into oblivion in the month before the November election. And I argue that instead of taking middle ground positions in a misguided effort to protect purple districts, that we then are seen as lacking the kind of leadership that is required to galvanize voters and attract a majority. And so that kind of reflexive compromise, and I don't think compromise is a dirty word all the time, but this reflexive compromise to say the only way we can get there is to ignore our longtime commitment to abortion rights and play that down because it's a 50-50 and it hurts Lipinski in Illinois, these kind of calculations have led to the perception that the Democrats don't stand for anything.
Well, Trump tried to tweet a lot of those candidates into oblivion in 2018, and a lot of them won. So I think that, you know, the politics being the art of the possible, Nancy Pelosi, if she wants to be Speaker of the House and control the House floor, some districts are, you're not going to elect socialists in some districts in Orange County or in North Carolina or in upstate New York. You're not going to elect socialists. So I think she's done a pretty good job of balancing the reality of what it takes to get a majority. And I think also the party should be principled, but it also needs to accommodate people of different views. It's important for the party to believe in the things it believes in, like the right to choice for women and controlling their own reproductive freedom. But Is the Democratic Party not open to having someone pro-life in the party? Is that an absolute a barrier to being a Democrat in good standing? In a lot of parts of the country, you'd be giving up some Democratic votes if that was the position. So I think that I really I really have a great deep appreciation for the idealism you're expressing, particularly at a time when, this is why Donald Trump got elected, a lot of people think the country's going in the wrong direction, and they're worried about their kids' future, and they're worried about the cost of college and real estate and wages. If you and health insurance, if you feel that way, then you want fundamental change. And if you want fundamental change, you need to support someone. You call it revolution or whatever you want, but you need to support someone who really wants to change things. And there's no doubt that the Senator Sanders' critique of America, influence of corporate interests, influence of the military-industrial complex, a failure to protect workers' rights and labor rights. I don't know that anyone could disagree with his critique. I don't. But that doesn't mean that the solutions he's offering are what everybody in the country thinks is the best thing. So the balance between idealism and practicality, not just to win elections and to pass things, but to have the country support it. I think the greatest tragedy of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, was candidate Obama said, you can't pass universal health care in a partisan way. You must make it bipartisan. Now, the Denver Republicans didn't make it easy. But if Bernie Sanders passed single payer, imagine how 40% or so, maybe closer to 50% of Americans will believe it's the end of life as we know it in America. Can he pass it and make it a unifying thing to make the country feel in a bipartisan way good about it? It'd be very challenging. So maybe he does have to temper his idealism.
Well, again, I see this as agenda setting, and I believe that the televised debates have spent way too much time in the weeds of comparing Clause 7A of my health care plan with Clause 14B of yours.
I agree.
These are all plans, and they're subject to passage through Congress. And I believe that Sanders will recognize that there needs to be a track that allows people who have a Cadillac plan and want to keep it to do so. I see single payer as the floor. And people can certainly, to the extent they can afford it, can add on from there.
You think they're...
But he doesn't want to yield that because it's a distraction, and it feeds into the Buttigieg, you know, Medicare for all who want it. And nobody, moderator or candidate, has raised any issues about the actuarial numbers. Can these plans actually work out financially? The only one that makes sense to me is single payer, whether it's Medicare or some other entity. And so that never gets discussed. It's all this neener-neener bullshit about my plan's better than yours.
I agree with a lot of what you just said, but let me ask you this. Do you think there's anybody in San Francisco where we're talking who would have less access to health care if there were single payer compared to what they have now?
Well, do you know that Gavin Newsom implemented a plan, and there is a public funding of health insurance in San Francisco. So it's a little anomalous, but my answer would be, I don't think anybody will suffer a setback where single payer would deal them coverage that is worse than what they have, because I don't think there's going to be any restriction on having additional insurance on top of that, and I don't believe that the healthcare insurance industry will be wiped out. It will certainly be cut back substantially if we have a single payer plan. But, you know, my comparison is I was a longtime national board member of AFTRA. You probably were a member. AFTRA-SAG.
One of my four unions.
Okay. And, you know, we negotiated contracts with TV and radio stations that set the floor, union scale. And people who could negotiate above that were free to do so. You pay more in dues, you pay more in your contribution to health and retirement as a result, but there was no cap that said you must work for scale, and this is a socialist enterprise where you can't negotiate for more. And I see that as the same model for single payer.
Why is the United States the only industrialized democracy that doesn't have universal coverage in single payer?
We don't have the will to pay for it.
There's why.
And we always...
Why does every other country, the citizens of every other country, have the will to pay for it? I don't know the answer. I've asked people this for 20 years. But there's something about America that makes us different than every other industrialized democracy in this regard. There's certainly a lot of scare tactics and straw men put up about long lines in Canada. You wait, you know, to see a doctor or specialist. But there's some truth to that. You know, my friends in the United Kingdom, my friends in Canada, they don't have the same system. Even if you're able to buy additional add-on private insurance, for most people, they would be dealing within the public system. And there will be implications for that for doctors and hospitals and every stakeholder in the healthcare system, which is pretty much everyone in the country. And Americans aren't willing to take that risk. Some are, but a lot aren't. And so I think that Senator Sanders has done an extraordinary job, probably more than anyone in the history of the United States, in making the prospect of single payer a reality for a lot of people and a worthy goal for a lot of people. But I don't think he's won over enough people to make this a reality. Our healthcare system is horrible by almost every metric. We spend way more for worse results. But people are attached to the notion of not having a government-run healthcare system. Not everybody, but a lot of people. And until that changes, until he's able, or someone working with him, is able to galvanize a higher percentage of Americans for this really big change for 1/7 of the economy, I think it's going to be difficult. Again, not just to pass, but I don't think we should try to pass it until there's more support for it.
Well, Mark Halperin, I want to thank you for a lively conversation and for your insights. Before we wrap up, I just want to ask you about your personal situation, because you were the subject of a Me Too campaign. From everything I know, you have issued appropriate apologies, but you are now in this gray area of shaming and shunning. And one of the reasons I took the invitation to talk with you today is that I don't support that. And I believe that you acknowledged inappropriate behavior on your part, and we don't have a structure for you to reclaim your dignity and your good name. And because I looked up some videotapes, if you just put your name in at YouTube, it'll run all night with these various clips, and they lump you in with Harvey Weinstein and Bill Cosby. And I think that is grossly unfair. And I just want to ask you about what it's been like to go through this, and do you feel that you'll be able to ultimately recover?
I don't really know what recovery would mean. I have a young son, and I just want to support him and be able to get him health insurance. From the beginning, I've tried to find the best path to make amends, to apologize to people for what I did when I worked at ABC, now over a dozen years ago, and to try to contribute to the discussion of change in our society. But it's complicated for me. It's complicated for anyone who goes through something in the public eye. But I need to try to make amends for what I did as best I can, and to live my life as best I can. So I'm not sure what the future holds for me. I'm just trying to do the best I can to, again, set right what I did wrong in the past and to go forward living the best life I can. But there's no doubt that I've created for myself a lot of challenges, particularly at a time when I've got a son I've got to support and raise.
But from my perspective, and I clearly don't know everything about the instances that you were accused of, but I'm really troubled by the fact that there's no process here, and that some of the accusations made against you may have been completely fabricated. We don't have any way of evaluating that.
Yeah.
And then we have to ask, you know, what was the quote-unquote crime? What is the appropriate punishment? And when do we let somebody like you out of the penalty box?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think society has reached any conclusions about that. Victims, for anybody's victims, need to come first in figuring out the right way to go forward. But I do think, not just for people involved in Me Too, but for anyone who's been subject to public scrutiny, and in some cases people who've, unlike me, who've done really nothing wrong but get caught up in something, that changes the contours of their life, lose their job, have to move, get death threats. I think it'd be great if society had a way to not only help victims get the closure and the sense of empowerment that they're entitled to, but to have a sense of proportionality and justice and fairness. And I thought a lot about where that might come from in society, but there's no appetite for it, or very little appetite for it, because people are afraid of standing up for anyone for fear that, you know, the mob will come for them. Mm-hmm. So I think it'd be great if we had more fairness in our society, and I think it'd be great if some infractions or crimes or wrong acts were not treated differently than others. I think there should be a little bit more equity. Again, not talking about me or even Me Too, but just talking about the way there's judgments made by Twitter and people playing off of Twitter that has produced a lot of negative things and a lot of unfairness. But that is unfortunately, I think, going to have to wait until people decide that they're not going to let Twitter decide who gets to work and who doesn't, who gets to have friends and who doesn't.
And Mark, I'm a believer in restorative justice, and I think it can be very productive when the victim and offender, under the right circumstances, can sit down and address the pain and hope to resolve the residual conflict. And I don't know if you've had a chance to see Van Jones' show on Sunday night on CNN, a little overproduced and too much dramatic tease before the break, but the content is solid. And they show us cases of people who were deeply at odds, who have found a way to communicate. And it generally is, you know, very helpful to both parties. Have you looked into that, and does it occur to you that that might be appropriate?
It's totally appropriate, and again, it's got to be oriented towards the victims above everything else. Based on my experience, I think it's extraordinarily powerful for everyone involved, putting the victims first. But it's difficult to do. I have friends who have hurt people, and they'd like to reach out to them, but it's very difficult to do. It's sensitive, and it's hard to find intermediaries who are considered honest brokers. You know, talk about restorative justice. We don't have an infrastructure for that. We don't have person A wrongs person B and wants to apologize. And they were afraid that if they call person B will get even more upset. A very reasonable concern. How do they address that? Can they find someone who's considered a neutral arbiter who's willing to step in? In my experience dealing with these issues over the last 2 years, again, less for myself than for others, although for myself, it's very difficult. It just is an interpersonal matter, is an institutional matter. I wish there was more infrastructure to do that, because I think that's the biggest barrier to the kind of reconciliation that you're talking about, which, again, is not for the victimizer, it's for the victim. But it's very difficult to bring about for all sorts of reasons, and Van Jones, I have great admiration for him on this. He's gone through hard things in his life at times, and he understands the importance of letting people move on and having the power to move on. But boy, is it hard to do. Not even if you're willing. I've been trying to do it. Was trying to do it from the first days, but it's hard to do. It's hard to find the right way to make it happen.
Yeah. Mark Halperin, thanks for your candid comments.
Thank you. Great to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with Mark Halperin. Send your comments to peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.